G'day everyone from sunny Melbourne. As you can see in the background, this is Tim Topham and you're listening to the timtopham.com podcast. It is so great to have you with us and thank you very much for listening. I know there's a lot of other things that you could be doing and other podcasts you can be listening to, but you've chosen to listen to me, which is fantastic. I hope that we can give you a heap of valuable information for your piano teaching studio today. This episode is about simultaneous learning. Now, if you've got no idea what that means, then I know you will know what the problem we're going to be solving with this is. And that's if you just ask yourself the question, have you ever wondered how on earth you're meant to fit everything into your 30-minute lessons with the students? How do you fit oral, composing, sight reading, music reading, the list goes on, into your lessons? If you've ever asked yourself that question or wondered how to do it better, then simultaneous learning is one of the things that can help you. Now, before we start today, I did want to thank today's sponsor, Music Teachers Helper, which I reckon is the best studio management software around for music teachers. And I'm not just saying that because they're a sponsor. I do believe strongly in their product, and I only have products that sponsor this podcast who I believe in and that I use. So you can use it to obviously schedule your lessons and get all your payments and tax reports sorted out. Good time of the year for that in Australia here. But some of the great little tricks is you can get it to email lesson reminders, good for teenagers and your adult students. There's a lending library, there's a repertoire tracker. The thing is just got so much information in it and so much potential for your studio. So look, head to www.musicteachershelper.com/Tim and there you can register for a 30-day trial. And if you choose to continue your access, you'll get 20% off your first month. So go and give it a shot. So look, thank you so much for watching. I get lots of great emails about the podcast from people. I had one just the other day from someone who was stuck in traffic. Melbourne has some pretty bad traffic jams, I have to say. If you're a Melbourne listener on the Monash Freeway, you might be listening right now in a traffic jam, actually. She was stuck for about an hour in a traffic jam and she said, look, Tim, I had this chance to listen to your first episode. It was fantastic. You know, it got rid of all my frustration. It was time, you know, the best time that I spent in the week on myself and my studio. So thank you for letting me know. The best thing to do, though, if you're enjoying this podcast and you want to help me get the word out there, is to leave a review on iTunes. And there was one that I had to just quickly read out because it made me laugh. This is from Cryptic Rubato, who says, Tim is one of the most dynamic and versatile of the new generation of music educators in his own right. But in this pilot episode, that's episode one, if you haven't listened to that, then make sure you check it out. It's one of the top rating shows so far. He shows that he can also bring out the best in those he interviews. This is 60 minutes that crackles with ideas to try and heralds the arrival of an exciting new and convenient resource for professional development for piano teachers. And he says, subscribe, make yourself a coffee, grab a notepad, and then shamelessly steal ideas for your own studio. So thank you, Philip Johnson. I love what you're saying, and that's what this is all about. If you're not writing everything down and making notes and trying things out and stealing all these ideas, then I'm wasting my time. So please use everything you've got, ask me questions, and if you can leave a review, please do so. Head to timtopham.com/iTunes, and all the information's there. Okie doke, enough chatting. I'm so excited to welcome our guest. He's been sitting very patiently. Our guest today is Paul Harris. He is one of the top music educators in the world, and it's fantastic to have him with us. He studied performance, composition and conducting at the University of London and Royal Academy of Music, where he now lectures in the principles of teaching. He has over 600 publications to his name. Yes, that was 600. Principal among them is his latest book, Simultaneous Learning, which is what we're talking about today. In addition, he's written many other works, including those on sight reading and oral work. He's even got 7 concertos, a ballet, and a children's opera. I didn't know any of that, Paul. That's pretty cool. The Virtuoso Teacher is one of his other books. It was published in 2012. And it has to be one of the books that was seminal in my own sort of pedagogical development. That and one of his other books, Teaching Beginners, I'll reference both of these in the show notes, have to be two of the things that have helped me become the piano teacher that I am today. So you can see Paul's writing in Music Teacher, BBC Music Magazine, and the ABRSM's Libretto, and the American ICA Journal. He's a performer, examiner, and adjudicator. I don't know how you have time for everything, Paul, but I'm so thankful that you're able to join us today. Welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
And I understand that you've been down under into Australia at some stage recently, or in the last few years.
Yeah, last few years. I've been a couple of times, actually. I've been to Melbourne twice. Sydney, Brisbane, and done the tour, really. Only one day in each, unfortunately. Very short tours.
Yeah, not long enough. Have to spend more time than that next time you're over. And look, I enjoyed a summer in Europe just a few weeks ago, actually. So unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to catch up. It was very busy for me. But I do enjoy getting over your side of the world as well. Now, before we begin, can you tell us a little bit about your current roles and your schedule? So do you mainly teach now, or are you so busy composing and writing and that sort of thing that you mainly spend your time doing that?
Well, I have what I don't know whether you call it this. We call it a portfolio career. And I just do a bit of everything, really. I used to be a full-time teacher. I started out as a full-time teacher. And then I started, you know, having all these weird, wonderful thoughts, started writing. And so I gave up full-time teaching. I still have pupils because that's my favorite thing. Teaching is my absolute favorite thing. I, as you say, I talk, lecture at the Royal Academy of Music. I do quite a bit of playing. I do some workshops. In September coming up, I've got about 15 workshops, all one day after another, beginning of the term, beginning of the new school year. I do loads of that kind of stuff. And examining, adjudicating, you know, a bit of everything, really. And a lot of thinking as well, which and experimentation in the nicest possible way with my pupils. And so we get a lot of fun out of it all.
Mm. Yeah, and that's how you kind of learn and develop new ideas, isn't it? Is that experimentation?
Yeah.
And I was just going to say, I mean, with the amount of writing that you're doing, are you writing at the moment? In fact, is there anything in the works?
Yeah, there very much is actually, and perfect to be talking to you today about this because I'm just trying out a slightly new idea under the sight reading heading, because it occurred to me. The reason why so many pianists, young pianists, are really not so good at sight reading, and, you know, I use the word not so good generously, if you know what I mean, it's because, and I this is not always the case, but a lot of piano teachers teach a small number of pieces to their pupils over quite a large number of days, weeks, months. So they may be learning three or four, particularly pupils who are going towards exams. So they're learning two or three pieces over a, you know, dare I say it, a 6 month period.
Or more.
So they're learning these pieces mostly by tactile memory, by kinesthetic memory, by oral memory, not by reading the notes. And so when they come to do some sight reading, they really don't know what to do. So what I'm doing is I'm creating a couple of books, what I'm calling one a week. And the idea is that while you're teaching, you know, the bigger pieces, you give your pupils one of these very short, quite straightforward pieces to learn every week. So always they are having to interact with notation, always having to learn a new piece. So as you're going up to grade one, I've done a grade one book and a grade two book. The pieces are only sort of 8 to 12 bars long. Got one sort of main idea in it, but lots of little ingredients. So you have to look at the notation. You have to spend a week looking at some new notation, because I'm sure this is one of the major reasons why young people don't get to understand sight reading, because they are not actually interacting with notation very often.
It's absolutely true, and readers and listeners will know that I'm obviously a big advocate for this, and the you may have heard of Elisa Milne and the 40-piece challenge, which has become quite popular in Australia, which is exactly that same kind of concept. And I had direct experience with taking on a student a few years back who had learned piano for 5 years, and she was 13 or thereabouts. And she literally had learnt three pieces each year in those 5 years. And the poor girl was just ready to quit because she couldn't do anything. It was just awful. Yeah. So I love the fact that you're going down that path. It can only be good for teachers and students.
So far, I've written about 55 pieces, so lots of pieces that can take part in the 40-piece challenge.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, how many would the book contain for, you know, a student who's working at grade one level, perhaps doing an exam, one a week?
One a week. Well, each of the books, I'm planning on having 26 pieces, from, in other words, A to Z, and they're going to have titles from A to Z. So we have 26 pieces each with a different letter of the alphabet, and lots of fun music as well.
So
for 26 weeks leading up to an exam, you know, should someone work it out, you can do one piece a week. It just kind of, in a way, formalizes that particular aspect of the learning and the teaching. Because I think teachers need a sort of formal thought in their mind if they're going to stick at something over a long period of time. Because, you know, a lot of teachers get, oh, this is a good idea, you know, I'll do that. And then they kind of stop doing it or they forget to do it. We need to formalize these ideas. Oh, yeah, okay, that's, I do this now and we've done that. I do it, you know, and so they kind of get into a habit of doing it every week. And under those circumstances, it will start to work.
Absolutely. And while I think about it too, I should just mention for everyone who's listening, I will make some notes about this episode and all the links, and they'll be at timtopham.com/episode9. So if you're in the car or whatever, don't feel you've got to try and write while you're driving. We'll have all those notes recorded for you. Are those books available yet, Paul?
No, I'm literally writing them at the moment.
Okay, exciting.
I was working at it last night, but we're hoping to get it out by about November this year.
Great. Well, you heard it here first on Tim Topham TV.
you really did hear it first, actually.
Excellent.
The first person I've told about.
Oh, fantastic.
At first, you know, apart from my publisher.
Right. I look forward to testing them out in my own studio as well.
Absolutely.
So, look, Paul, the whole reason that I wanted to speak to you today was regarding this question that I get asked by heaps of teachers. They all say, Tim, you've got these great ideas. We love your composing and your 12-bar blues and your improvising ideas, but how on earth am I meant to fit all of this into my lessons? Particularly, as you say, if you've got a student preparing for an exam and they have to have their general knowledge and their oral and they've got to sight read and learn three pieces, you know, how do you do it? And so I know that you are someone that has some incredibly great ideas about how and you can approach this. So what would you say to teachers who are feeling this way?
Well, okay, you've got to kind of change your mindset slightly. We have to move away from the kind of teaching where people comes into the room. So say you've been learning a piece for a week or two. People comes into the room and you say, okay, sit down, start playing to me, and then we'll get into this process of you play and I start correcting your mistakes, which inevitably is what happens, because under those kind of under that kind of teaching, that's what happens. People comes in, they start playing, they're making mistakes, say no, that's not right, it should be this. And that kind of teaching, and I'm obviously giving you the worst case scenario, but that kind of teaching to me is frustrating, because pupils never quite live up to your expectation, and they're always making mistakes. And so what's going on in their mind is, you know, well, I can never really quite do it. I go to my teacher who tells me how to do it. So it's a very teacher-led sort of learning. The pupil is dependent on the teacher. And it all goes in a slightly negative sort of way. So I'm suggesting we flip that around. And perhaps I can give you an example on the first lesson on a new piece, because the first lesson on a new piece, I think, is critical. My first thought is, let's not have the music or the dots or whatever you want to call it open. Teacher knows the piece. You know, I know I'm going to teach minuet in F. It's in F. It's in 3-4. It's got some of these patterns in it, these rhythmic patterns, these melodic patterns. It's forte. It's stately because it's a minuet. I'm going to take those ingredients and I'm going to explore them with my pupil. Without the music on the music desk, we're going to explore. We set up a 3-4 pulse. We do some thinking of pulse. So many lessons to me don't actually start with pulse. Loads of them, I would say, actually. And further down the line, teachers and pupils wonder why they can't do dotted rhythms. They can't do dotted rhythms because they don't really have a very solid sense of pulse. Because if you do, then you can put a note between two pulses just as easily as on a pulse. But you have to have that. So all lessons start with pulse. We do some pulse work.
I find that students, I'll ask them to count in something before they begin just to make sure they set that pulse, because I'm right with you, I agree completely. And it's amazing. Half of them go, oh, do I have to? Like, they almost think it's embarrassing. And I said, it's just so important, isn't it? Where's the pulse before you begin?
Do the pulse. It's essential. And keep coming back to it. You know, my brain's going to go off in so many different directions.
No,
this morning.
Go for it.
Another problem, I think, with a lot of teaching is that we say something to a pupil, saying, this is it. We kind of teach them, and then we think we've taught them. But, of course, we haven't. You have to repeat things. You have to reinforce endless times for someone really to get something. And it may be years. And it may be that a pupil can do it, and they smile at you and they say, yeah, yeah, I can do that. But in fact, has it really gone into their deep learning? You know, is it really gone backstage in their mind so that they really understand it? And I would suggest, for most people, the answer is no. We have to keep on doing it over and over again. So the pulse thing, every time, literally every time, and eventually a pupil will get it. You know, but just because they smile and can do it doesn't mean they've got it. Mm. So we do pulse. And then we play around with some of the ingredients. When I do improvisation, it's not, you know, jazz, it's not four-bar phrases, it's just tiny little ideas. And it may be no more than two notes. You know, here's some ingredients, we say. F major, 3-4, and a light touch. Let's improvise something using those ingredients. And if a pupil goes to the piano, I don't have a piano in this room, but and they play, I don't know what F is, I don't have perfect pitch, but they go to the piano and they play, bom, just an F. Okay, one F. And they say, well, I counted 3-4. 1, 2, 3, bom. I play that F. I played it with a light touch. It had a minuet sort of feeling about it. It was one note, but it was an improvisation. And it shows me that, yeah, they've understood F major, they've got the 3-4, they've got the light touch, they've understood the minuet quality just in one note. And to me, that is an improvisation that has tremendous worth. And from that point, you can move anywhere. Obviously, you can move anywhere from that. And then we just spend some time working with whatever ingredients I think this pupil can cope with in that first lesson. No more, no less. And, you know, some pupils are fast, some pupils are slow. Slow pupils are not bad pupils, they're just slow pupils. Mm. And we move at their pace. And if we're moving at their pace, it feels like fast to them. And I think this is one of the great characteristics of the really great teacher, is that they really understand the pace at which each pupil is moving, and they go at that pace. Mm. And so they're always moving fast. The pupil always feels as if they're moving fast, but at their speed, and therefore they're always achieving, which is one of the key principles of simultaneous learning. We always move at the speed of our pupil. Mm. But anyway, so we're working at these ingredients, and then we decide, well, that's enough on this piece. And then somehow or another, we represent those ingredients on paper. I have my own idea, which I call my simultaneous learning practice map, which I may explain later if you want to. Mm. But we represent these ingredients. Pupil then goes home and thinks, okay, now, in the minuet work we did today, you know, we introduced the note F, the first five notes of F major, a light touch, 3-4, this rhythmical group. And I'm going to explore those ingredients at home. I'm going to think about them. I'm going to do a little improvising. And then I'll move on to another piece, which perhaps I'm learning from notation. Pupil comes back for their next lesson. Teacher says, what have you done? And you say, oh, I've done this. So, you know, I made up this little one-bar piece. I did this and that. And so that it's not mistakes we have to correct, because the pupil has understood those basic concepts, whatever we decided to work on, and we move on from there. Mm-hmm. And so we're basically moving in a positive direction, not correcting mistakes, not working on things the pupil doesn't understand, and we move forward. And one of the principles of simultaneous learning is that we take these ingredients, whatever we think the appropriate ones are, we put them into a context, we make connections. So, for example, we connect scales with technique. In this piece, you have to play with a light articulation. So let's take the first five notes of F major, which are the staple notes of this piece, and let's play them with a light articulation. At some point in this piece, you have to play forte and piano. Let's play them forte and piano. Let's take this rhythmical germ, which, you know, comes a lot in this piece, and let's use that rhythm for every note in this scale. Now let's make up something, a little 3 or 4 bar phrase, using these ingredients. Let's listen to F major silently. Here's an F. Let's listen to it in our head. So a little connection with oral. And as the lesson goes forward, the simultaneous learning teacher is thinking in connections, is thinking in ingredients, and just knows what the next thing to do, what the next activity to do is, that is going to take that particular pupil forward in a positive kind of way. It's not play and I'll correct your mistakes. It's a lesson is a kind of sequence of activities which just grow from whatever the first activity is in a very organic, imaginative kind of way. And it makes the lesson really thrilling for both teacher and pupil, because the teacher is not sitting there waiting for the pupil to make the next mistake.
Which will be the same as all the other mistakes that people
have made. Exactly. Right. And the pupil is not sitting there in fear, thinking, you know, what's my teacher going to make me do next that I can't do? They're not thinking that, obviously, but that's the feeling. They know the pupil is thinking, well, I can't really do this. I sort of can, except for, you know, the top 10% of good genius. I don't want to use the word good. The top 10% who can do that kind of thing and who work despite the teaching, if you know what I mean. I'm looking at all 100%, how to get the best out of all 100% of those pupils. And then they can do it. And it's a thoroughly positive, exciting experience for all. And just another point I want to make before I just finish this bit of a surge I'm doing at the moment. Teachers say to me, but we have to judge our pupils. You know, a pupil does something, we have to judge them, and then we move on. And yes, of course, that is exactly right. We, as good teachers, are making judgments all the time. A pupil does something, we make a judgment on that. But we never tell the pupil what that judgment is. We don't say, oh, no, that wasn't very good, do it again. Or, you know, try that again, but do it like this. What's happening is that we are judging, and that judgment in our mind then sets up the next activity. We think, oh, yes, they did it like that. I think the next activity should be whatever it is, a connection here, a little bit more work on that ingredient, because that is going to take this lesson forward. The pupil can do this, and they can't do that, but rather than make them do that again, I'm going to bring in another ingredient to help them do that and to move it forward in a positive, organic kind of way. I hope that's clear. I've been kind of talking too fast.
Absolutely. Well, look, I've been writing down a few questions, so because I want to make sure that everyone can keep up and I'm trying to think of the questions that I think people ask. So if I just take a few steps back, one of the first things you mentioned was this idea of just improvising in a style. And I know that for a lot of teachers, whenever they hear improvising, they think, oh, I'm not a jazz teacher. I wasn't trained like that. I don't know what to do. So I love the thought that you said, look, it need only be one note. As long as it's you know, fulfilling the purpose of that ingredient that we're trying to test out. So, you know, I assume that they could do other things as well. They could do a series of a few notes or something like that, but it doesn't have to be difficult, right?
Absolutely. Nothing is difficult. If you hold on to what you just asked me, Tim, I'm going to go off on another slight tangent for a moment.
Sure. Nothing
is difficult in this world. Nothing. I in my latest book, Simultaneous Learning, I've written a section which I call The Myth of Difficult.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is this. If we can't do something, it's not difficult. It's just that we can't do it. Now, I can't fly a plane. But if the pilot said, now, I'm going to fly you from Melbourne to London, it's very difficult, but I'm going to do my best. Now, the passengers are not going to be very delighted with that.
Right.
Because the pilot finds it easy. You know, it's easy. The pilot can do it. I can't drive above, do a plane, but it's not difficult. It's just that I can't do it. And I want to dispel this idea that anything is difficult. If we move in a logical and sequential way towards our goal, as long as we want to achieve that goal, we can do it. And if a pupil says, I really want to learn this piece, we say, I can guide you between us. I will teach you, you will learn how to do it. It's not difficult. Well, we have to move there in a very logical and sequential way, and you have to learn each thing to allow you to do that. So that's the way that we move forward. Improvisation is not difficult. It's absolutely not difficult. And it's something that every teacher should do. I remember doing a whole day's workshop a little while ago, and I had little sections, sessions, each with a title. And the last one was improvisation. And the number of people that had to go early, oh, sorry, I've got to go, can't stay for the last session today, improvisation.
Yeah.
You know, so many teachers are just frightened of, or threatened or fearful.
Yeah.
It's so easy. And what I say to teachers is, take an ingredient of a piece, and it may be, you know, a tiny little teaching piece, maybe a Beethoven sonata, and take one ingredient, so Beethoven sonata in F minor, take one ingredient, the note F, and just improvise on one note, you know, at different dynamics and different touches. That's improvising. It's just making something up. And as soon as you get that idea, that it's just experimenting, exploring with ingredients in the music, it suddenly becomes doable, and it suddenly becomes tremendous fun. Tremendous fun. Pupils love it, and teachers begin to love it as well, and they stop being worried about improvisation. And that particular idea of taking ingredients out of a piece, mixing them together, mixing dynamics with touch, with rhythms, with whatever, it becomes such a fun thing to do, and it suddenly allows us to explore the ingredients of the music without the constraint of, oh, you know, I've got to get that right, and I don't really understand it. It allows us to really explore that. And then once we understand it, which pupils will do, then we put it into the piece, and they get it, and they get it right. And they can play this music with so much more understanding.
It sounds really good. I wonder whether one of the other concerns that listeners will have is, for a number of teachers, this will be a big jump. As you say, it's a kind of reversal of what a lot of us were brought up with. So how should they start? Is it a good idea to kind of practice, find a piece and pull it apart before you have a student, or what should you do?
Yeah, exactly. So say you're going to teach. I've been talking about minuet for no particular reason, but say you're about to teach a pupil a minuet in F by Mozart, and it's just you know that very Mozart's very first piece, I think, was a minuet in F, K1 or something like that. so you look at the piece, and you know a teacher who's been playing with music for years can look at the piece and can understand its ingredients in 15 seconds. You look at the music and you say, you can either write this down or not, but you say, okay, it's in F major, it's in 3-4. These are the main repeated rhythmical groups. It needs a light sort of articulation. These are the dynamics. Okay, so you've got 5 or 6 ingredients there, which are obvious. And the more you play this kind of game, the easier it is for you to actually understand what the ingredients are. Pupil comes in for a lesson and you say, okay, we're going to start working at a minuet today. Let's explore the scale, because they need to understand scale. They say, oh, I can't play F major scale. Okay, but you can do the first 3 notes. You can do the first 5 notes. Let's explore those. So we could set up a 3-4 pulse and we just go tom, 2-3, 1-2-3. Perhaps just some simple little idea in 3-4 using the basic notes of F major. Let's add a lighter articulation to it. 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Let's add a bit of dynamic, a loud bar and then a quiet bar. Let's now add a rhythmical unit from the rhythm somewhere in the music goes bom 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 bar. We add that. Bom 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 bi. Let's play an F in the left hand, just an F in the left hand, no more than that, and we put the two together, where we've really got something musically meaningful. Absolutely. just by exploring the very basic ingredients of the piece, and they are all ingredients of the piece. And you know, the teacher then, I'm never prescriptive, and I would say to the teacher, you may want to do this for one lesson, because the other pieces, I hope, are being learned at the same time. You may want to do this for 2 lessons or 3 lessons. And eventually, when you feel this pupil has really understood the ingredients of this piece, they know what this piece is about. Let's now open the book. Here it is. Oh, yes, it's minuet in F. I understand a lot of these ingredients already. There's that rhythm, and it's in F major, it's in 3-4. There's the dynamics. I kind of understand it. This is the pupil speaking.
Yep.
And now we start working at it from the notation. But with the pupil already having tremendous insight into that music, they've already got it. It's not, here is your new piece, and pupils thinking, this looks like
a whole lot of black.
I don't understand any of it. And here, well, let's start at the first bar, you know, and I'll tell you how it goes. You have a go, and I'll correct you when you go wrong. Yeah, as you will. Yeah. Inevitably will. And we get into that sort of really negative kind of teaching.
It's revolutionary. I love it. It makes so much sense, of course.
I think it's so easy to do. It's so easy to do. So you know, I've introduced 1 or 2 words. We work at the ingredients. Mm-hmm. We make connections. And my third word, which is my third most important principle of simultaneous learning, ingredients, connections, we are being proactive rather than reactive.
Yes.
We are, and I simply mean by that, you know, we are setting up each activity in the lesson. We are not reacting to our pupil who may be able to do it, but probably won't.
Mm.
Not reacting to that. So we got proactive, ingredients, connections, and they are the kind of the three basic tenets of this. It's an obvious way of teaching. I don't think I've invented anything new, really. I've just taken what I think to be good, seriously imaginative teaching and giving it a label and set out formally how you can do it.
I must say, I've definitely used this procedure particularly with blues and boogies and things like that. So we talk about the ingredient of the left-hand pattern. One of the ingredients is the 12-bar blues progression, of course. So, I find, and perhaps, you know, the use of the seventh or the blues scale, things like that. And, you know, they're key ingredients. And I find that absolutely that students, when they see what that ingredient is, in particularly in those left-hand patterns, for example, you know, half the pieces is learnt. It makes it so much easier. But I haven't used it so much with classical or Baroque kind of repertoire, so I'm going to have to try that myself.
I absolutely maintain that you can use this. I call it an approach to teaching. You can use this approach for any style of music, any genre of music, at any level. So you can use it for the very first bit of notation you ever teach a pupil. And I really think you should. You know, the very first piece you teach, you come from it from this simultaneous learning angle. Or you can teach a Beethoven sonata using the same process.
Yeah.
Literally, any way from the first to the most difficult, and I don't believe it's difficult, it's just complicated. And you know, if you can understand it, you can do it. You can teach anything like this.
Mm. Absolutely. Wouldn't a Beethoven sonata or some of those big works just take too long to use this process with because there's too many ingredients?
No, not at all, because there aren't that many, actually, when you look at it. There may be a lot of complexity in it, but if you actually think about it, there aren't that many ingredients, particularly a good composer like Beethoven, who uses the same ingredients in all sorts of different ways. And when I'm teaching my sort of diploma-level students, I do exactly that. I just take out important ingredients. We explore them. They may be technical ingredients. You know, ingredients can be technical or musical. So we may take out technical things that need looking at or musical things. We explore them. Because I hate the idea of let's start at bar one and just start playing until you make a mistake.
Mm.
You know, because I can't see the point of that. That doesn't seem to me to be good teaching, good learning. I want to think about what's in this music. I want to explore the character, the feelings, the moods, the emotions, which are all ingredients. I want to explore the technical things, and then once we've done that, then we open the book and we start looking at how we fit the whole piece together. But we do that with a lot of insight already built into the pupil or student.
To be completely honest, I could see this being as 100% as valuable for the teacher as for the student, in that it's going to actually make me as a teacher really understand that work, because I'm going to have to pull it back to kind of its bare bones and work out what are those ingredients and if we take Beethoven, for example, you know, what's the underlying chord progression that has been embellished into this thing that he does that's so amazing? I think it's a great, you know, just a great technical exercise almost for a teacher to do that.
It really is. And I think the ultimate connection I think this is in a way puts the whole thing into a perspective. When I'm examining, I examine for you know the Associated Board, the UK board, which is good fun. That one of the things that I so rarely get to hear is character in performances. You know, they've got up to the state of being able to play the notes and get the rhythms right. Do you get character as well? And one of the problems with getting character in is that you need brain space. You need the space in your mind to be able to think about how I'm expressing this music. If all the brain space is taken up by, well, we've really got to remember the notes, got to remember the rhythms, you know, got to remember that technique. If all those things are taking up brain space, there is no room left for actually getting to the spiritual centre of a piece of music. If we do the simultaneous kind of learning where we sort these things out, we really sort them out. You know, pulse is really understood. And people really instinctively and deeply knows what pulse is, whether they're playing a piece or whether they're sight reading, they know what pulse is. They know what these things are. There is room in their mind to get to the emotional, the spiritual content of the music they're playing. It makes it easier for them to be musical, you know, whatever that exactly means. But I think a lot of children don't do that because there's not that space in their mind to allow that to happen, because the space is all taken up by all the technical things. Because if you have to remember this piece is in B flat major, I've got to remember those two flats, that takes up a lot of brain. And there's no room left for thinking about the other things, which at that stage is more interesting. Now, the latest research on the brain and on the working memory, which is the bit that does a task, is that the working memory is actually quite small. And, you know, this whole thing about multitasking, they're now thinking that we can only multitask with a very few number of things, not very much. And so which is the thinking bit of the brain that you're using as you do a task, is actually thinking, well, I've got to remember the flats, I need to kind of think what that rhythm is. If it's having to think those thoughts, because those things haven't become instinctive, there's no room to think, okay, now I've got to play this with this lovely shape, and I've got to get the character here, and the character changes on that note there. You know, all that much more interesting side of stuff, there's no room for it. So it's no surprise that, you know, a lot of people don't go to that particular place because their brains are taken up by the stuff that we should have got really understood and deep into their long-term memory.
Right from the beginning, yes, I agree. Yeah. You haven't mentioned listening to music, listening to ingredients or music, or writing. Are they either of them things that you would consider useful?
Hugely so. I mean, if I can be a bit naughty and show you my practice map, I've got one here. This is something I devised. It's called Simultaneous Learning Practice Map. Don't know whether you can see it at all.
Yep.
But it's got little bubbles, which is where, after that, during the course of the lesson, both the teacher and the pupil fill in together. So we got no rhythms, so they could put a couple of rhythms in there, and the time signature of the minuet, for example, the F major in the keys, technique, no light, articulation. And down here we have listening. And because every week I want the pupil to listen to something. You know, we have YouTube. We're a fantastic resource, and most young people have access to it. So I say to them, spend 1 minute. You know, they're very busy, and so I say, just spend 1 minute. You can find a minute, can't you? Yeah, I can find a minute. Find a minute and get onto YouTube and just type in minuet in F, because that's the piece we're doing. And it doesn't have to be this particular minuet, just any minuet in F, and listen to it for 1 minute. Just 1 minute. And then, you know, next week, I'm going to ask you about it, and, you know, what did you like it? I'm not going to ask you, you know, can you write it down? You know, can you analyze it? So, did you like it? Did you hear it? That was good. Or you might even see whether you can find, because there are available on YouTube, people dancing minuets dressed up in 18th century costume.
Ah, yes.
You know, so find a YouTube clip of some people dancing. So you know what a minuet is. You know, you're playing music, and this is what would be going on in the background. So listening, I think, is tremendously important. And, of course, it opens up a huge area of potential, because you might ask them to listen. And once they get into the habit of 1 minute of listening, you can then develop that. And you can say, well, this week I'd like you to listen to the sounds that particular performer makes when they play that minuet. Or this week I want you to watch them. Or you might do even something more technical, watch their hand position, or look at this particular minuet and look at the way they negotiate that, just for 1 minute. No, we don't want more than a minute. And each week you begin to develop their listening skills, because they get into the habit of, I've got a minute a week I can spend listening. Now, and of course, 1 minute might develop into 2 minutes, might develop even
five minutes,
you know. May one day develop into 20 minutes. They listen to a whole sonata, or they listen to a whole something. You know, if you set it up well and carefully with a young person, they just start doing things. But you've got to be very careful. You've got to set it up carefully.
Now, I've got a question about keys. One of the challenges, I think, often for teachers is students will want to learn, at some stage they'll want to learn a piece of music that's in a what we call a tricky key, I guess. You know, they're used to playing in one or two sharps, and suddenly they want to play something in A flat major or D flat major. Yeah. And that's an ingredient. I wonder in your opinion about how do you get kids to, as you say, put that in the back of their mind? How do they engage with that so they don't have to think about it all the time? Because that's one of the trickier things, I think.
Yeah. Well, the first thing about playing most keys, most scales in most keys, is that the first three notes are quite easy. I'd really want someone to tell me, no, the first three notes in that key are really difficult. I would challenge anyone to say to me, oh, here's a key where the first three notes are really difficult. And I would say they won't find one. Because nothing's difficult, as we now know. So we can start playing around with the first three notes. And because the first three notes are easy. In fact, the first five notes are easy as well. And I want to play around with those notes in a kind of simultaneous learning, playing with the ingredients sort of way to begin with. And so we just improvise with three notes. We'll play them, improvise with them if we want to. And then, and this is a key thing, now we look at the notation. Here is the notation of those first three notes. Mm-hmm. And we might write out the key signature and the first three notes. Oh, we've got a scale book and we just look at it. Here's the first three notes. Because that particular connection in the lesson, I think, is very important. As we're learning scales, which we normally do from memory, I want always to make, perhaps, I don't know, perhaps you may do it always from notation. In this country, we tend to learn them from memory because scales and exams are always played from memory. And teachers
do it the same. I do anyway, yeah.
So teachers rarely make the connection with the notation. And I would like to say always make the connection with the notation because you're seeing what it looks like. It's not difficult. You're just looking at it. Okay, that's what it looks like. There's the key signature. I'm taking that in. I'm seeing the first three notes connected with the key signature. I'm making that connection in my mind. And that's the way to do it. So we continually, little explorations with the notes of the scale. And it may be that we only do the first three notes for 2 or 3 weeks. We may then introduce the next two notes. We've got five notes. Or we may introduce the whole one octave scale, perhaps. Here's the notation, so you're getting an understanding of what those notes look like with a key signature in front of it. Until it becomes unthreatening, until we've taken the fear out of it. And then we begin then to work on that. Yep. Teaching always has to be very sequential. And very logical. And if we move in that sequential, logical fashion with all pupils, they get things. If a pupil doesn't get something, it means we're moving too fast for them. Mm. We haven't made enough connections for them to understand it. And you know, and if a pupil doesn't get something, we must never blame them. That's a mistake I think teachers sometimes make. Oh, you must be stupid. You must be a slow. Yeah. I think we, in the nicest possible way, we should take responsibility. You haven't understood that. It's my fault.
Yeah, why is that? I ask myself that question.
Yeah, exactly.
How do I redo it? Yeah.
Exactly, Tim. I've got to say it in a different way. I've got to teach you in a slightly different way. I've got to come from a different angle. I've got to bring in some other connections here. Because eventually, everyone will get it. Hmm. It might take a long time for some people. That doesn't matter.
Okay. Yeah.
It's okay. You know, if we teach the right thing at the right time, a pupil will get it. If we teach the wrong thing at the wrong time, or even the wrong thing at the right time, or the right thing at the wrong, you know, any of those things, it's going to get in the way of learning. Mm. It's essential, and again, this is another key ingredient of a virtuoso teacher, is that we're teaching the right thing at the right time for that pupil, and then they are always able to move forward. Because they always get it. So when it comes to keys, we make the appropriate connections, notation, you know, the perhaps it's a technical thing. You know, you've got to get your right fingers in the right place at the right time as well. If we get all that right, a pupil will get keys.
Mm. Yeah, I think that making the connection to the notation, that's the thing that is most important and probably things that I certainly have forgotten to do. So that's a really great tip, Paul. I was just thinking in what you were saying then in regard to exams and the way that they can get in the way of quality teaching too. And we have quite a strong exam focus here in Australia, where students tend to get on the exam express, I've heard it called. You know, one year, each year they do one and they get off at the end and they stop playing piano because they've done all their exams. And I can see that kind of focus, when students aren't necessarily ready, oh no, we've got to start our next grade pieces, so let's begin at bar one sort of thing. Whereas you're saying, no, it really depends on the student. The student might take 3 years to learn the ingredients of grade one, let's say, sort of thing. Have I heard you right in that regard, do you think?
Completely right. I mean, you've opened up a big area there, Tim. I mean, that's a huge problem, really. Yeah. I don't want to get into the whole parents thing, really. Parents love exams because they think it represents progress. It represents a kind of progress. It doesn't necessarily represent the best kind of progress for their particular child. I've nothing against exams. I love exams. You know, I examine for the AB in this country. But I think it's important that we drop a pupil in for an exam at the right time.
Yep.
And if a pupil thinks that learning to play the piano or any instrument is simply one exam after another, then, you know, what a horrible thought. And almost always that pupil will give up at some point because it's stressful. Mm. They equate learning music, learning the piano, learning an instrument with exams. Exams are stressful. And so if that's what music is, it's not going to work. So I'm for exams. It formalises a lot of important things about playing an instrument. But let's drop in for it. And I will only drop one of my pupils in for an exam if I feel they are at that grade or slightly beyond it.
Yes.
So you can play these pieces. We could learn one of these great pieces in 2 weeks. That's how long it takes you to learn a piece because you are at this grade. Mm. You can sight read, you understand sight reading, you understand notation, no problem at all. You understand the scales because you understand it's one of the ingredients. So they say, yeah, I'm happy, I'll drop it for that exam.
I've got to stop you there, Paul, because some teachers might have missed what you just said, which was, and I like your thinking, a student is ready for an exam when they can learn an exam piece in a couple of weeks. Which is, you've just kind of blown everything out of the water here because most teachers would say, you know, they're ready for their exam after they've learnt the piece because it's taken a year.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it doesn't mean you don't teach the same...
Excuse me.
It doesn't mean you don't teach the same pieces however way you teach them. It's just the whole kind of psychological process and how you see these things as part of the journey. And if your journey is we work towards an exam for a year... then we take it, and then, oh, here's the next exam book on the next lesson, and then we start working towards the next. That, to me, is a dispiriting kind of teaching and learning for the pupil. We can still do that in a funny kind of way, but we just don't say, here's the new book, and we're going to do the exam in a year's time. Mm. We learn pieces, and we learn... I know, I love Alyssa's idea of the... I don't quite know the 40-piece thing, but I get it. I mean, yeah. Without knowing. I know exactly what she's on about, because we don't teach enough pieces. Mm. I want to teach more pieces so that pupils understand what they're doing, and so they can learn more pieces, and so they understand more. And because we are teaching it that way, it goes in that direction. Mm. And so what we're building are musicians, young musicians, rather than pupils who can play a couple of pieces just by the skin of their teeth, and then go and do an exam. And then, you know, and this is the funny thing, you know, 2 weeks later, you might say to one of those people, oh, could you play me a piece? And they say, oh, no.
Exactly.
Yeah. I can't play a piece. You know, so what's that? Because they don't really get it. They're not learning to play the piano and learning a repertoire. They're just learning exams. Mm. And that to me, and I don't want to upset anyone, but that to me is a restricted way of learning and teaching. And I think teachers feel very restricted by that as well. And I'll tell you another thing, actually, if I may drop this one as well.
Yeah.
We're always teaching pieces that are slightly too difficult for pupils. I teach quite a few teachers, actually, and they come to me for lessons once a month on a fairly, you know, irregular basis. And one of these teachers said to me, and she's a teacher now, so she actually managed to get through, but she said, you know, when I was a young learner, when I was a child, all I can remember is playing pieces that I could never play. that I can never play computers as I was learning. They were always difficult for me. And we also have this thing that, you know, here is a piece, and the next piece you're going to learn is going to be slightly more difficult.
Yes.
You know, or at the same level, if we're learning grade pieces, for example. But we get into this habit, and I think if we say, now, let's learn this piece, we don't tell the pupil, technically it's maybe more simple, let's learn this piece. And we know it's technically more simple, so they're going to play it quite quickly and enjoy it. Children love playing from A to B, from the beginning to the end of a piece. Mm-hmm. It's a nice thing. I can play this piece, you know, and get from beginning to end. They like that. How often do we give them that opportunity? And I can see in Alyssa's 40-piece idea, you know, I'm guessing it will give them that opportunity a lot more often.
Yes,
and a child feels great. I've played a whole piece, so I've really enjoyed the sensation of playing from the beginning to the end of that piece. How often do we give children that enjoyable sensation?
It's exactly what it's about.
You know, the most hard-grained exam-based teaching, you know, gives that child that opportunity so rarely. Mm. You know, that's finally at the exam, after a year's teaching, they can play three pieces from beginning to end. Mm. And even then, for a lot of them, it's not absolutely secure. You know, how many times have I sat in as an examiner and heard hesitating performances of a child actually in the exam room? Well, what's all that about? You know, how can they have been allowed to play to me as an examiner in the exam room and they still can't play their piece in a relaxed, secure way?
I love the hearing what you're saying, because it goes to the heart of what I'm about. And look, I'll put a link to the notes I've got already written about the 40-piece challenge. It's this idea of trying to break out of this cycle of only learning 3 to 6 pieces in a year for a student. And look, if you're a teacher who's listening and you do currently only teach a few pieces a year, then it's actually quite easy to break out of that by just giving, perhaps choosing one student to whom you can give some easy pieces. And I call them 1 week pieces. And they're generally sort of 2 or 3 grades perhaps below where they're currently operating. And they don't need to really know what grade it is or anything like that. You just say, here's your piece. Let's have a quick look through the ingredients and enjoy playing it this week. And then we get another one next week and we keep track of it all. So it's very doable. Even so, don't freak out if you've never done it before. It's quite doable, and I'll link to some notes about it.
And that's exactly at the base of my these two books, which I think maybe we may call them 1 a week, actually. I think that seems to be a good title, 1 a week.
I'll have to get a credit for that.
Well, I wish I had. I've already done it, so I've got it on my...
Oh, that's all right. Now, just while I remember, you held up the practice map before. I wonder, is that something that we could give our readers? Is it a PDF that you could share, or is that part of a book that's, you know, a different kind of thing?
It comes in two guises. They come in pads.
Right.
And I've done a practice, a sort of practice book. Mm-hmm. I haven't got a copy here in my room here, but it's a very new style practice homework book.
Okay.
Because another recent book of mine is this one here. It's called The Practice Process.
Okay.
And it's a whole book on practice. And I did a lot of research and talking to children on that one. And one of the things I found talking to so many young people, talking about their practice, and I said, you know, how does your teacher represent the practice? Oh, in a notebook. And how much notice do you take of that notebook? I don't know whether
I know what's coming.
Exactly right. And you wouldn't believe the number. And I said, you know, to tell me the answer, because I'm not going to tell your teachers, I'm not going to tell your parents. I just want, it's just research. I just need to know this information. The number of children who said, I never even look at the notebook. Yeah. You know, I remember certain things the teacher did if I practice, and that's why, but I don't look at the notebook. And so I thought, we've got to get away from the linear list, which most children are not interested in. And so this idea of bubbles, a very small bubble, so you just put in a key word or a key symbol or something, and then the pupil takes that home and makes their own practice out of the ingredients, and it seemed to work really well. And so I've created this new practice book that has that on one side, and then some boxes where you can put more symbols, pictures, ideas. It's a much more imaginative way into practice. So I can put this when I do. I'll do my sheet for you as well.
Okay.
If you don't, I can put these things on it, and you can have a look at them anyway.
No, that'd be great. So Paul's just mentioned his sheet. I've asked him if he could put together a kind of checklist or a summary sheet, cheat sheet, I guess, of this idea of making connections and ingredients and things like that. And he said before we started recording, he said, "Yeah, I'll do it afterwards because who knows where we're going to end up with our conversation." So thank you very much, Paul. We'll put the link to that. Will be in the show notes as well at timtopham.com/episode9. So thank you very much, Paul, in advance for that. I look forward to using it in my studio myself. Now, look, I can't believe we're almost at an hour already. It's just gone like that for me. So I'm just going to have a quick look through. I had just a couple of other quick questions. You've actually answered a lot of the questions that I was going to ask you. One of the things I was just saying there, you've just talking about exams, because I am interested in this as a topic. You're clearly not advocating ditching the exam process. It sounds like it's more about it being used in the right way. But for teachers who don't want to use exams or, you know, would like to try something different, what other kind of goal, like longer term goals, are there for students if they're not kind of sitting in an exam, but the teacher's very used to preparing students for an exam? What else could that final summative assessment be?
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely understand what you're saying, Tim, because it's important that we have outcomes. I'm a process over outcome teacher from the point of view the process is so important. Now, what happens now in this lesson is really important. We need to enjoy it. We need to find it an imaginative and interesting experience. But at the same time, we need outcomes. And I want teachers to begin to think about both short-term and longer-term outcomes. And we can have loads of short-term outcomes. Like, for example, next week, in next week's lesson, I want you to play me the first note of this piece beautifully. Okay, that's a really simple, obvious outcome. Just the first note or the last chord. Next week, I want you to play me the last chord beautifully. Or it could be the whole piece, of course. So we can present little outcomes like that. Or you know, boys love personal best. I don't know, in Australia, certainly it's in here. But, you know, how many of these notes can you repeat in, you know, 10 seconds? How fast can you play your C major scale? How many C major scales can you play one octave? You know, that kind of thing. And they love this sort of personal bit. Oh, I can do it 7 million times. So boys, I'm not being sexy because girls like that as well. But we want to find out what children like to do as kind of short-term outcomes. Longer-term outcomes, you know, if a teacher is able to have their own little student's concert, lovely. I love those kind of ideas. And at the end of a term, everyone plays a piece. And it could be a tiny piece or it could be a long piece. That's a nice outcome that kind of fits in with the exam thinking teacher. But it's not an exam. It's just a performance at the end of a term. And by the way, a point about that, which I always talk about when I talk to teachers about that, is don't put your most advanced pupil last. Because that sends out a message that I just mix them up, because I don't want people to think that because that person is more advanced, they are better than me.
Sure.
I want to get rid of that. They're more advanced. Mm. They're not better. Mm. And you know, if you have 5 or 10 pupils all playing their piece, they can all play their piece beautifully. They're all as good as each other. Just because you're more advanced doesn't mean you're better. And I want to get rid of that kind of thought in a teacher's mind. So that's another idea. We can have little students' concerts. For some teachers, with some pupils, we may have a scales concert, a scales competition.
All right.
But a scales concert. Or we can have a sight reading afternoon. You know, we're going to come. I've done a book of. Sorry to plug my books a tiny bit, but I've done a book in my Improve Your Sight Reading series called Sight Reading Duets.
Yes, I've got a copy over there.
Oh, that's fantastic, Tim. And it's for pupils, one bit, and teacher plays the other. And so we may have, what we're going to do, we're going to have a little get-together one afternoon, and we're just going to sight-read duets together. Pieces you've never played before. But, you know, teacher will take great care to ensure that pupils will be able to do what they're going to ask them to do. Don't put a pupil in an uncomfortable situation. But there's all sorts of, once we start thinking outside the box, there's all sorts of little outcomes, little events, little things we can do performance classes where you get a group of children together and they play their piece to each other, and the children make interesting comments. We teach them the kind of comments to make. You know, we're not criticizing, because we don't criticize. You know, the good simultaneous learning teacher is never criticizing. We don't criticize. We are helping them. We are moving them along in a very positive way. And, you know, when I hear a really good simultaneous learning teacher teaching, they never criticize. Mm. It's not part of the vocabulary, because that's not what the forward motion in a simultaneous learning does. What we do is we think of the next activity based on the last activity, and we move in this positive direction. So we can eventually have pupils having little performance classes instead of an exam, for example, at the end of a term. We get together and we talk about each other's performance. So, oh, I really like that. When I play that piece, I do this. Mm. You know, well, how that, you know, and it's just so interesting. Mm. Give children the opportunity to do this kind of thing, and they love it. You have to build up their confidence. Of course you can make a comment, you know, because most children will say, oh, no, I can't comment. Yes, you can. Mm. Anything you like, just compare it to the way you do it, and children begin to get that confidence and can do it. We open up a whole new area of behaviour.
I just love that all your idea. I'm going to kind of wrap it up now because I think we're about an hour in. I love that all your ideas are really all-encompassing as an educator. So, you know, that skill of getting students to listen to other people, not only are they using their ears to listen, they're having to think about what they might say, and they're broadening their vocabulary about music. So, you know, they're just fantastic ideas. I really think it's great. I don't know how I will ever have time to read 600 or whatever it was of your books.
There's really about five or six of this kind, but look, they're all very thin. Can you see that?
I do, and they're all nice and small too.
Yeah, I like thin books because teachers don't have time to read anything other than thin books.
I want to. I'll ask you a question about your books in just a moment, but I just want to go right back to the beginning and just make sure that for everyone listening, we have answered our question. So the original question was, for teachers that are wondering, how do you fit everything into a 30-minute lesson?
Yeah.
And your one or two-sentence answer would be?
You start with an ingredient, and then you just make connections. You, in your mind, you have a map of all the things in music, sight reading, scales, key, technique, all those things, and you see now I can make a connection there now. And literally in a half an hour lesson or a 20-minute lesson, it's amazing the number of connections you can make. All those things can be brought in.
So you just now, instead of pigeonholing everything, okay, I'm going to do music reading now, I'm going to do sight reading now, I'm going to do oral tests now. Yeah. Instead of that, it's all just interlinked.
Yeah, and all you have to do is touch on them, 30 seconds, 1 minute. But you keep on coming back at different times. You keep on reminding your people, we're making this connection again now. And then it kind of builds up like that in their mind. It's not pigeonholed in their mind. And they begin to understand how music fits together. They, like we do, because we do it instinctively. Most people don't do it instinctively. We have to teach them. And they begin to understand. Mm. Hundreds and millions of connections grow from their brain and they get it.
Oh, I love it. I can't wait to kind of try out some of these ideas, Paul. It's been so good talking with you. I would love to speak even longer, but I do want to try and keep it to an hour. So where can people go to find out, firstly, more about your writing and that sort of stuff?
Well, I have a website, which is called paulharristeaching.co.uk, which is a very big website, and every book is on it and stuff like that. They can find loads of stuff there. There's my publisher, Faber Music, have quite a bit on me as well if you want to go to the Faber Music website.
Is that .co.uk? Is that
I'll do, on my sheet, I'll do all these.
Okay, that'd
these,
be great. Yep.
I'll do this. You did mention, you know, is there a way, as a result of this particular session, whether people can get a slight help on some publications if they wanted to?
Sure.
And I've spoken to them that it's a slightly complicated thing because of the distance and postal charges. And I'll put this on my sheet as well. If you want to ring up Faber, it will be in London. They will give a good discount to anything. But there will be the postal charges. There's nothing we can do about that, really.
Sure.
They're looking in to see whether there is an Australian distributor. I mean, all my books are available in Australia and everywhere. But I'll look and see whether there is a particular distributor for them.
Great. So anyone that's interested in your books, don't go and buy them just yet. Wait until we get Paul's sheet, and we'll put the information and that in the show notes so that you can find out what the special discounts might be and whether they're applicable to your area. Does that sound okay?
Sounds great.
Yeah, beautiful. So, I appreciate you speaking to your publishers about that, Paul. That's great.
That's a pleasure. That's a pleasure.
All right. I think we're about there. So look, the show notes will be at timtopham.com/episode9. And as I mentioned right at the start, thank you so much again for watching. If you're enjoying this, the best way to say thank you is to leave a review. And you can do that at the link, which is timtopham.com/iTunes. That will give you the link to actually how to do it. And the more reviews I get, the more I move up in the rankings and the more people get to find out about the show. And my biggest passion, like yours, Paul, I think, is to help as many teachers as possible improve their practice, because that's going to flow on to the students.
Absolutely.
So any final words before we sign off?
Well, just been great to meet you, Tim, and what you're doing is absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. And all we do as teachers is try to inspire our pupils, you know, to send them home after lesson with a bit of energy and a smile. And so to come to their next lesson with some more energy and some more smiling, and so we're making this thing work. It's fantastic. And we know, I mean, why do we do it? We know the bottom line is because it makes their life a bit better. You know, not a huge amount better. It makes their lives a bit better. Yeah. And if we can have people playing music, you know, it's a lot better than doing other things that some people might be doing. You know, say no more than that. But it's been great. Thank you so much. I hope we keep in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you again for your time. So that's it, everybody. I'll see you in episode 10. Ciao for now.